picks
position
it up.
Number 22099,
and,
Lil Tame.
Real Six, Side One, Captain David Render.
When we were in Ironbeck, the war was now over, sort of thing, and we got the tanks all lined up on a sort of ceremonial basis. And I can remember that, or coming up to a ceremonial basis, and I can remember I woke up and I could hear all this squealing and squeaking of tanks. And I thought, oh my goodness, what have I done? Overslept or something? And so I leapt out of bed, you see, and rushed over to the window. And to my absolute horror, there was a complete line of, I don't know, 10, 12, 14 Panthers drove straight into Ironbeck and gave themselves up. I've never seen a sight like it. I mean, they were totally battle-worthy, and the chaps were all in their uniforms and everything else, standing up there. And the tanks were immaculate. And they just drove in, gave themselves up. I mean, they could have blown us to smithereens. And then, of course, I was put with the A echelon with a chap called Major Roger Nelthorpe, who subsequently became colonel of the regiment, and was, in fact... an important person in Nottingham, High Sheriff he was later, and I was in Ironbeck. And by the way, when we were in Hanover, I had my 21st birthday there, and I had a party and so on. My 20th birthday. 20th birthday, not 21st, that's right. Because when the war was over, I'd still got 4 months to do before I was 21, so that was right. It was the birthday of my 21st. And so then they said to me, righto, well, you've now got to go back to England. So I came back to England and was told immediately to report to Catterick. And when I got there, a major in the guard room said, would you come this way, sir, and see the brigadier? So I did, and he said, I thought he was going to tell me that it was all over and I was going to go home. And he said, well, what was your experience? So I told him what I'd done and all the rest of it. And I said, well, I was, you know, looking forward to going home. And so he said, well, I see. Well, take this next door, will you, please? So I said, yes, right. I so saluted him, walked out of the guard room, out of his office, and along to the guard room. And I couldn't help looking at what he'd written. And he put, I recommend this experienced officer for immediate transfer to Southeast Asia Command. So, with my heart in my boots, I then made my way back home, and my mother and couldn't believe what I was doing, because they all thought the war was over. You see, they'd got the flags out here and all that sort of thing. And so, I then had to go down to New Haven, and we went down to Toulon, and across to Alexandria. And when we got there, because we were on our way to the Far East, they suddenly announced that we wouldn't be going any further.
So could I ask, when you were shipped out, was that part of a unit or as an individual?
Individual. Mm-hmm. The Sherwood Rangers we left behind. So we got to Alexandria, and a captain chap said to me, you are not going any further because they're going to drop a bomb on Japan and stop the war. And I can remember saying, don't be silly, they won't stop the war with a bomb. What are you talking about? It must be a blooming great big bomb. So he said, well, we don't know what it is or anything. You notice the theme all down the line. We never knew what was going on. And so he said, well, that's the way it is. We don't know what it is, but they're going to stop the war with it. So I can remember saying, well, it's ridiculous, but anyway, if that's it, if we're not going to Japan, that's good. Because, in fact, by now I knew that I'd been earmarked because I had done a very limited amount of swimming or wading of tanks in training. And so I knew then that it was to be the invasion of Japan, you see, because everybody was talking about that. So, and I thought, well, I'll never get back from that one, but still. So anyway, I wasn't to go, so they then said, well, you can, and I met up with a chap from the North Anzio, Munri, and with that we teamed up together, as it were, and joined what was being on offer, which was to be with the Derbyshire Yeomanry, who had armoured cars, Staghounds. And we joined them at Kassassin in Egypt, and we went into the Tel Kabir barracks for a bit and all that sort of stuff. And then we went up the desert, and we were at Barchi and Benghazi, and then Tripoli, and then we were down south in a place called Garian, which is about 140 miles down south. And then I suppose after a year and a half of that in the desert, I was promoted to, well, before then, after about 9 months or a year, I was promoted to be Tekaj of the regiment.
So what were you actually doing in the desert? Was it just...
Troop leader.
Again. I mean, what was the role of the...
Oh, well, the role of the regiment was such that at the end of the war, old Winston Churchill stood up and said, we must be magnanimous in victory and we must allow the conquered countries to recover. And with that, Naren Bevin stood up and he said, yes, he said, and on that theme, he said, we must give back all the lands to the conquered countries. And, well, that caused chaos in the Middle East, because the SAS, when Rommel was on the rampage, had zoomed up to places like Yefren, where we went to, which was well south of Tripoli, in their trucks and things, and hold up, and they used to get the Arab blokes in their in their funny old clothes to go wandering into Tripoli and telling them they've just loaded 14 Mark IVs and hundreds of barrels of petrol and all this sort of thing, and they would tell the SAS, who would then radio back to Alex, and then they would then mount a bombing raid and give them one. And in the circumstances, our SAS blokes said, if you chaps, you Arabs, if you'll do that for us, you see, what we'll do is we'll look after you, we'll get rid of these horrible old Italians who've occupied your land. Because if you remember, Mussolini regarded Cyrenaica as the granary of Europe, because you can get two corn crops off in a year because of the weather. And of course they all got pushed out. I mean, we used to see their little houses they built, like little square houses in rows with a piece of land, and apparently they would say to the Italians, right, well, you can go there and there's a house, there's the fire in the grate and a piece of land, till it, and that's it, that's yours. And of course the Arabs resented this like mad. So when the end of the war came and they expected to get Tripolitania back, Gaddafi's land as is now, they were told, you know, oh, they're going to give it back to the Italians again, because Tripoli, for instance, was divided into half. There was the Italian side and the Arab side. The Italian side was very nice, and the Arab side was a bit of a shambles, to be honest. Anyway, the fact was that the Arabs rose up and said, you see, got very angry. So the Derby Yeo was sent up there to shut them up. Well, to be perfectly frank with you, we young troop leaders, who I might tell you were afraid at this time of nothing or anybody at all, I mean, you know, nobody could upset us, were sent off on sort of schemes, or whatever you like to call it, trips, to patrol the desert, you see, down at Garian or whatever it was. And so D.D. Render's, Lieutenant Render's troop of armoured cars, staghounds, would swan off into the blue for about a fortnight, and we would go down, and I'd learnt quite a bit about map reading and the sun and everything, I might tell you, in those days, because it was life or death if you didn't behave yourself with that. Anyway, we'd go down, and we would come across a Bedouin encampment, you see, and we'd go over to them, and they were very nice to us, actually. And so we would then, on one particular occasion, I remember, we went into their tents and so on, and they'd got a carpet on the floor and a tent and one thing and another, and they produced this couscous, you see, a big bowl of rice with them. I was sitting there, you know, as the big I am, and they kept putting the things in front of me, and of course the great delicacy is the sheep's eye, and I had to eat a sheep's eye, which I might tell you was a big problem to me, but nevertheless one did. You also drank the tea, you had to drink 3 cups of tea, and that was sugar tea, mint tea, and what was the other? Well, it was just ordinary. Then it was with sugar, and then it was with sugar and mint. That was considered all quite kosher. Notice my Arab. So anyway, next thing that happens is that they suddenly announced on this particular trip that they were going to put on a show for me, you see, for us. And they lined up 2 lots of their chaps, and they galloped their old horses down with all sort of bones sticking out and all the rest of it, and they fired off their rifles into the air, you see, ta-da, you see. So I said, right, well, in that case, we'll get the big I am, and we had him in the armoured car, and we drove him down the line, you see, like they'd done with their horses, except that we fired off our 37 millimetres, you see. And they thought it was wonderful. And I expect, if the truth be known, they're still talking about it today, those old boys, if they're still alive. But one of them said to me, tell me, he said, where do you come from, you see? And I said, well, I come from England. England? Oh, yes. Mm. Well, he got a remote idea where England. And so I said, yes, I come from a place called London, which is a big place in the middle of it, you see. So he said, ah. He said, and what's London like? He said, is it like this, all sand all over London, just the same as here? And I mean, you know, that was the sort of thing that we met with them, which was quite fun, really. But they were very, very nice old boys, and I was very interested to realise and learn how they lived, you know, how they moved from... The reason why they're Bedouins, of course, is that their animals eat the grass, and then they move on to the next lot of grass. They don't do any work towards it. They just vandalise the place, really. And but nevertheless, they were very, very keen on having their land back, and in fact, they were very keen on us. As a matter of interest, when we were in the desert and we had things like white scout cars breaking down, we just used to drive out in the desert and find a white scout car lying there and take the bits we wanted off as our spares. In 1947, that was 46, 47, and the bits were still there, just the same. They're left from the war. Unbelievable. Aeroplanes, all sorts of things were about. So then I got sent back to England and demobbed, and I then started up my company after having had a bit of a forced start with trying to work with Dad. And that's how it went on from there. But of course, Ware Crete is another story altogether. But looking back on it, to be honest, I must say that I'm glad that I had the experience of that. It taught one a great deal about human nature. You learn to very, very much respect other people. I'm very... keen on England. It's my country, and I feel, you know, as if a lot of people have done a lot of contributions to it, through not only in those days but up until recently. I have a great respect for the army. I never personally fought the army at all. I never was on a charge all the way through. You might say I was a sissy, but it wasn't a matter of that. It was I just did what I was told, and if you do what you're told and go along with it, then it's like a great big family. If you behave in the family, things go all right. If you misbehave in the family, they don't. And I've always found it was more than friendship. I often said that when you hear of an old parson saying, you know, love thy brother and all that sort of thing, I mean, a lot of people say love their brother, they think they're talking about queers or something. But of course, I know what it means to love your brother. And in fact, I know what they're meaning. They don't express it correctly, of course they don't. But the point is that, and you notice from that, I'm not particularly religious, is another thing. But the thing is that, in principle, the attitude of the senior chaps to the young boys was fantastically good. I mean, they were marvellous. They realised that they had the job to do. They were very sympathetic. The doctor, particularly in our case, the Sherwood Rangers, he would not sleep on a bed when the regiment was in action. He would not eat food in the officer's mess other than what the men were eating. In other words, he had the stuff out of the K rations. He would work himself inside out. How they could, he and the padre could look at what went on in the tanks, I cannot understand. I mean, it must have been horrendous for them. The padre would never have anybody to help him dig the holes that he had to dig, probably 6 and 7 in a day, because he said that he didn't want the young boys looking into the tanks seeing what would have happened to them. And they'd never go back in the tanks again, he felt. That, of course, often whizzes through my mind when I see today talk of girls being in tanks in the front line. Really, they just do not know, these people, what they are talking about. The fact is that it takes tremendous moral fibre to keep going in the tank in action. On top of that, of course, I have to tell you that when we went into the towns and we used to say to the blokes, right, fall out for a smoke, you're all right now, they would immediately disappear straight into the basements where all the civvies were, and you couldn't get them out until they'd done whatever it was they wanted to do. I never asked any questions on that score, but nevertheless, as long as they came back on time, I let them get on with it. But the fact is that it would be total nonsense. If you had a girl in the crew, you'd never get a troop in action because they'd all be after the girl. And also, I think that the girls, I mean, this is not to say anything against women as a whole, but, I mean, a lot of women can be quite strong and quite tough and are super pilots and all this sort of thing. Everybody knows that. I mean, I'm not trying to say you condemn every woman, but women uphill and down. But I think if you take the general run of women in battle, if you put a whole lot of women in battle, like you have to put hundreds of men in battle, you'd soon see what would happen. On the other turn of the coin, you see, the Russians apparently had women tank drivers, and a Russian woman tank driver was in command of the tank, you know. She actually told the gunner when and where to fire. She aimed the tank at the target and said, fire. And another thing was that the Russian tanks apparently, particularly at places like Kursk, they just drove at the Germans, who fired at them and knocked them out left, right and centre. But more came, and more came after that lot had gone as well, and then more after that. And in the end, they just drove into the German tanks. Well, of course, I've thought about that afterwards, and I think if only you've got the guts to do it, it wasn't a bad idea, because the German tank couldn't fire his gun if you were right there, could he? He'd never get him. He'd never get you. So that was actually, if you got the bottle to do it, which I must say I wouldn't have had the bottle to have done it, but if you could drive the tank right up against the other one, he's had it.
and have a fist fight with the opposing commander.
Well, that's right, you see. But that's what the Russians did. They literally did that. And, I mean, it's amazing. So, the sum up now is finally this, that there was a very interesting article in the Telegraph of a couple of days ago about the 1418 war in particular. The British generals were described as donkeys and all this sort of stuff. But in point of fact, it's very easy, isn't it, from the safety of peacetime to say, was it all worth it? Well, of course the answer is, of course it was worth it. I mean, the fact is, at the time, which of course is very different to the time that we live in at the moment you can walk out of my house here and walk down the lane and it's okay. But if you walked out of the house here and as soon as you put your head round the top of the lane here and you started getting shot at by some bloke, that's different. And one's reactions have to be totally different. I was in the Home Guard here in Totteridge during the war, and all this was like a little armed camp round here, I can assure you. Roadblocks and things where we pulled rope with blankets on a thing to stop the tank, so that when he stopped and said, "What on earth's this? Can you imagine this?" And we were to jump out with bottles on fire and chuck them at the tank. We had one piot with one round in it, by the way. But the thing is that, I mean, it never dawned on them that, of course, the bloke had got a gun that would fire about 400 or 500 yards away and blow the blankets to pieces. But that wasn't the point. The attitude of the people was that we will do them. So, under the circumstance, in the circumstances, as Karl said, a German tank group who we captured, the Sherwood Rangers captured in the desert, said to us after, some years after at a dinner, which we asked him to speak at, he said, "The 5th Panzer Regiment worked on three basic things: patriotism, integrity, and comradeship." And when you come to think about it, our mouths hang open, because when you come to think about it, that's exactly what we were. It was patriotism, integrity to each other, and doing, when you were told to do something, you did it, and comradeship. Well, anything that was yours was mine. I had a case of a man recently. I went on a motor rally, and this chap came up to me and he said, "I know who you are," he said, "and my father was a tank soldier," and he said he knew that I was going to see you, and he gave you this, and I have it in there, and it was in fact a toothbrush. And I said to my wife, "What do you know about this?" Well, she looked at me astounded. She didn't know what I was talking about. Toothbrush? Well, of course, the reason what he was getting at was that in a tank, if you needed a cigarette, you'd have one of his cigarettes without a thought. If you hadn't got a toothbrush, you used his toothbrush. And we all did this sort of thing, even though I was an officer and they were troopers. Because, in fact, we lived and died together in the blinking tank. And that is the point about having girls in a tank. You wouldn't get any fighting done. They'd all be on top of the girl, I tell you that for nothing.
All right. Thank you very much. That's great.